Ellington is, of course, the absolutely greatest composer in all of jazz, in the history of jazz.
He was a great composer. He was a God-given composer because Ellington openly admitted he didn't go to school to learn all this. This was something that was given to him.
He knew how to find the special qualities each person had and develop those through his music. And he taught the players in his band who they were.
He was dukish. He was royal. He was anything that you could think of. He was above the crowd. And yet he was a very comfortable person to be around, very thoughtful.
Duke Ellington was one of America's greatest composers, excelling in a field that wasn't supposed to produce geniuses. Ellington took jazz, still in its infancy, and turned it into a sophisticated, internationally celebrated art form. He wrote popular songs and serious works, musicals, operas, sacred concerts, and full-length orchestral suites. He created history's finest jazz orchestra and conducted it all over the world for more than 50 years. And he had other immense talents as well. He was a showman, ambassador, pianist and writer, and an eloquent defender of his art and of his racial heritage. We'll find out how a bright yet unremarkable teenage boy developed into a musical genius, an accomplished composer and musician who led the most popular big band in America for half of the 20th century.
To the greatest man in the story of jazz. Ladies and gentlemen, we present Mr. Duke Ellington.
I'm Nancy Wilson. On this edition of Jazz Profiles, our first look into the genius of Duke Ellington.
Duke Ellington grew up at the beginnings of jazz and then started working professionally in the late teens all the way through 1974.
Conductor David Berger.
So all the great developments in jazz, he was there for them. He caused some of them to happen, and other ones he took those ideas and then incorporated them into his larger style.
But Ellington aspired to be far more than a jazz composer, and he fought any categorization of his work. His music eventually expanded the jazz form far beyond what anyone had thought it could be, or even should be.
Jazz isn't big enough, he would say. I write music, I try to write good music. There's only two kinds of music, he would say. There's good music and bad music. If it sounds good, it is good.
Ellington wanted, of course, to write the hit songs, the popular songs.
Gunther Schuller, author and composer.
And he was always torn between this desire on the one hand to make the big commercial hit, but on the other hand to stay with the original conception. Ellington had so much artistic integrity, he would not just collapse and go along with the commercial pressures. He was always resisting that.
And where did he get his ideas?
Ideas? Oh, man, I got a million dreams. That's all I do is dream all the time.
Yes, Duke Ellington was a dreamer, but also a risk-taker, a restless innovator with his music. And more than anything else, he was his orchestra, Gunther Schuller.
We know he always thought of his instrument as being not the piano, but the orchestra. He had this instrument to experiment with.
¶¶ Ellington's orchestra gave him a chance to hear his music immediately, develop it, and make refinements. His compositional style became dependent on his orchestra and the creativity of its individual players. David Berger.
Duke Ellington loved other musicians, and it was those musicians that inspired his music. He never said I. In an interview, he would never say, well, I wrote this, and I play this, and I got this award. And no, it's always, we do this. It was always we.
Ellington saw his musicians as extensions of himself. They were all performers and composers together. Clark Terry, one of Ellington's great trumpet players.
He allowed individuals to insert little bits and pieces of their own personality. For instance, on the end of one tune, da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da. I started doing that on one occasion. He says, yeah, keep that in, you know. And he was just beautiful like that. So he had an idea that he could use all these people, use all their ideas, and still, it would still be Ellington.
But perhaps the most defining thing about Ellington was his relationship to his audience. They always came first. Entertaining them and pleasing them was something he never lost sight of, no matter who that audience was.
All races liked Duke Ellington's music, so to me that was integration.
Fayard Nicholas, legendary tap dancer and performer.
It wasn't just black people who liked Duke. Everybody liked him, which made him so great. That's how he reached everybody.
When people listened to Ellington's music, they forgot that they were white.
Stretch Johnson, author, scholar, and performer.
They became human beings listening to great music. It gave them a moment in which they could transcend themselves.
For Duke Ellington, his job was to entertain the audience, to draw them into his world.
David Berger.
And as soon as he had them in his world, then he could spring on them all the great stuff he just figured out. Duke Ellington was not only a genius in music, but a genius in dealing with people's personalities. He knew how to give everyone that he touched something that they really wanted.
Edward Kennedy Ellington was born in a black neighborhood in Washington, D.C. on April 29, 1899. His father, James Edward, was a coachman and butler who had worked in the White House. J.E. introduced his only son to a proud black middle-class society in which charm, culture, manners, and elegant clothes were key elements for success. Ellington followed his lessons well enough to earn the name Duke. Ellington's mother, Daisy, raised young Edward as though he were blessed. His feet were not allowed to touch the ground until he was 7. Overly protective, Daisy walked him to and from school. They attended church together, twice on Sundays. She also made him take painting and piano lessons. But it was an unlikely form of music that would soon capture Ellington's fancy. By the time he was 18, Ellington had lost interest in school and declined an art scholarship at Pratt. Instead, he painted signs for social functions and could often be found at Holiday's pool hall. Boyhood friend and longtime drummer, Sonny Greer.
During those days, I was a pool shop. I used to see these guys, you know, shop guys standing on the corner. And you know, from the moment I met Duke, you know, you see people, you take an attachment to it. That was it. And he wasn't even a professional, but he could play piano. He could play 2 or 3 numbers. He could play piano.
This is Duke Ellington playing Soda Fountain Rag. the first piece he ever composed. He charmed all those he met, whether it was playing pool or piano. Pianist Willie the Lion Smith.
This good-looking guy walked up to me and says, hello there, Lion. Says, I'd like to sit in with the boys. I said, this'll do you good, young fella. I said, you better sit in. I said, I think you get a lot of riffs and a lot of ideas.
He talked about Willie the Lion Smith in Music Is My Mistress a lot.
James Newton, musician and composer.
And Willie the Lion Smith was also a really wonderful composer. The same for James P. Johnson, Fats Waller. That is such a ridiculously high level of piano playing and just complete musicianship. All of those musicians mentioned were incredible composers also in their own right. And the level of musicianship that occurred between those gentlemen is simply off the map.
It's a look into the genius of Duke Ellington on NPR's Jazz Profiles. I'm Nancy Wilson. In 1918, Ellington married a neighbor's daughter, Edna Thompson. He was 19, she was 17. Their son, Mercer, was born March 11, 1919. Now, with a family to support, Ellington became more serious about earning a living as a musician. By this time, Ellington had developed a repertoire of four or five numbers he could play on the piano, just enough to get him work playing society events, provided he repeated those numbers in different tempos.
I said, well, this is a pretty good business. I think I'll go into it. So I put my ad in the telephone book. I was a pretty good businessman then, 17, 18 years old.
In 1923, Ellington moved to New York, to Harlem, which was the lively capital of Black America and home to a remarkable number of creative people in the arts. He worked first as a piano player for Wilbur Sweatman and then for Elmer Snowden's The Novelty Band, which he eventually took over. By this time, he was beginning to compose seriously. But how he learned his craft remained something of a mystery. Gunther Schuller.
He didn't know Harmony 101 from Harmony 102. He learned it from the piano. He simply took what he would play on his left hand, for example, and orchestrated it. And very often, he could do very well with three notes. But the genius was that he picked the most interesting three notes.
Surrounding himself with musicians and composers whom he admired, Ellington began to absorb many types of music, among them classical music. Composer, author, and pianist Billy Taylor.
Ellington was greatly influenced by European classical music because his mentors and his heroes were people who were well-schooled in the classics. Will Marion Cook from Washington, D.C., was a great composer who was an excellent concert violinist who had studied to be a classical violinist.
Will Marion Cook was a conservatory-trained musician who took an interest in Ellington and had a significant impact on him. John Hassey, Ellington biographer and musical curator.
Will Marion Cook urged Ellington, first you find the logical way, and when you find it, avoid it. Let your inner self break through and guide you. Don't try to be anybody but yourself. And I really think this became Ellington's private musical credo.
Ellington combined these insights with his imagination and intuition to write pieces that would not only capture the sights and sounds of his new home, but would also become timeless classics. This new, powerful body of work had one common thread that made it unforgettable. Bubba Miley on trumpet.
Pieces like East St. Louis Totolo and Black and Tan Fantasy were really built to feature Bubba Miley, who had this extraordinary repertory of sounds on the trumpet.
John Hassey.
And deeply influenced Ellington. I believe it was Bubba Miley's playing more than anything else that stimulated the transformation of Ellington's band from a polite society band into a bona fide jazz band.
Still, despite Ellington's new, innovative work, it wasn't easy making a living in New York. Ellington and his band, the Washingtonians, were like dozens of other small bands struggling to be recognized. Then came a momentous meeting. Irving Mills, a local music publisher and booking agent, dropped by a Times Square speakeasy to hear them. Big changes were in store for Ellington and his band. Irving Mills and an early promotional clip.
And now we come to one who seems to be set entirely apart from all other composers and musicians. When I first heard him, he was conducting a little five-piece orchestra up in Harlem. Today, he is acclaimed by music authorities both here and abroad as the creator of a new vogue in music, Duke Ellington.
Mills orchestrated a marriage for Ellington like no other with the Cotton Club.
The Cotton Club. I see. Oh, yes, I remember.
Duke Ellington.
It was a day of audition, and I think it was about four or five bands were auditioning. And everybody was supposed to be there at noon, and we didn't get there till 3 o'clock. And everybody had been there and auditioned and left, and we came at three, and we got the job. And the reason we got it was because the guy who says yes or no, he was late, too.
Oh, I see.
When you come to New York, if you didn't see the Cotton Club, you ain't seen nothing.
Sonny Greer, Ellington's longtime drummer.
They had the most gorgeous colored girls. They had the best colored talent in the world. That was the Cotton Club.
From December 1927 to February 1931, Ellington led his own house band at the Cotton Club, Harlem's mob-controlled speakeasy. This long-term, high-profile engagement solidified Ellington's growing reputation. His work became instantly recognizable across the country, courtesy of the raucous Cotton Club shows, which were broadcast live nationwide each night.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to our famous Cotton Club. It's great to see so many friends here tonight enjoying themselves in spite of the cover charge. And if you can spare a minute from your merrymaking, I'd like to have the pleasure of introducing the greatest living master of jungle music, the rip-roaring harmony hound, none other than Duke Ellington. Take your bow, Dukie. Thank you.
Ellington's band became known at the Cotton Club as the Jungle Band. But for many performers, the real jungle was the music business, and its chieftain was Irving Mills. A tough businessman and a savvy promoter, Mills relentlessly promoted his prize client, Ellington. He booked the band, made the deals, masterminded the publicity, and made sure band members were well treated. Most importantly, Mills gave them financial stability. Ellington biographer John Hassey.
Irving Mills was so important to Ellington. He wanted to make sure that Ellington got the respect that most African-American musicians did not at that time. So he had press kits produced. He ensured that at the Cotton Club there were printed programs, and he booked Ellington into the top places. He broke through all sorts of racial barriers. He got Ellington into Broadway theaters that hadn't hired a black band before. So he was really crucial to Ellington's success in the first 15 years of the Ellington band history in New York City.
But some say he also profited too heavily from their music.
White people like Irving Mills realized the value of talented people like Duke Ellington, and a lot of people wouldn't deal with black artists.
Jazz impresario George Wing.
So he dealt with black artists because he knew there was something there for him. So he did what he wanted to business-wise with Duke, and then, in a sense, you could say stole from Duke. But Duke said, look, he stole from me, but I might never have made it without Irving Mills.
Whatever the case, Ellington and Mills benefited from each other's talents. They both knew it, and they tolerated each other. Their arrangement also gave Ellington plenty of time for another important activity, after-hours inspiration.
Smooth, if you look in the dictionary under smooth, you'd see his picture. I mean, he was really very smooth.
Ellington vocalist Joya Sherrill.
And he said to me, like I used to say to him, I said, Duke, you know, you tell all these women, you're jiving all these women. He said, no, Joya, I love every woman that I'm with. I love her. I thought, wow, he's too much.
People talk about how he was attracted to women, but they were also attracted to him.
His granddaughter, Mercedes Ellington, remembers.
And, of course, he loved that. This interplay was a great source of energy for him, I think. You know, he renewed himself with the energy of a relationship with a woman.
I was always fluttering with excitement when I'd see him because I knew that there was going to be some wonderful exchange and I would be the beneficiary.
Jean Buck, Ellington's friend and a film producer.
And I was out sailing or something one day and I had this absolute marvelous suntan at the end of the day and I thought, oh, I got to show myself off and I'll pick up another compliment. He said, he looked at me and he said, oh, you look so marvelous. He said, I've always wanted, and then he stopped and he backed up. He said, I've always had a tan, but he said, you give tan something. So I thought that's pretty good. So a few weeks later, I heard him telling some woman that she gave blue something. She came in a blue suit. He said, oh, you look so attractive, you give blue something. I thought, wait a minute, you know, that's my line. Then I really tossed up my hands in despair because one day I heard him tell some woman that she gave tall something.
I'll never forget when he played Ciro's. My wife, who incidentally was a famed beauty, was wearing a gold lamé gown, which was tight-fitting.
Sid Culler, Ellington's friend and Hollywood screenwriter.
Duke came to our table after the show, kissed her hand, then her cheeks, and he said, Maureen, I'm so jealous of your frock. And she said, why, Duke? He said, because it's closer to you than I will ever be.
Despite these distractions, Ellington had, by 1930, lifted his band to a status equaled by no other black ensemble in the country. At the same time, his compositional skills were developing and becoming widely recognized, as you will soon hear. I'm Nancy Wilson. On this special edition of Jazz Profiles, a look into the genius of Duke Ellington from NPR, National Public Radio. By 1930, Ellington was doing far more than just writing and recording dance hits. He appeared in the early 1929 sound film Black and Tan. Later, he was a featured act in Flo Ziegfeld's popular Showgirl. His band accompanied the French singer Maurice Chevalier in 1930, and he appeared in the Amos and Andy feature Check and Double Check. No other black orchestra or black bandleader came close to this popular success. But Ellington was not only finding time to write pop songs. His new work was breaking into uncharted territory and defied categorization. Gunther Schuller, author and composer.
Ellington thought of himself as a real composer, and I think outside of maybe Jellicoe Morton, where that could be said, he was the first one in jazz to do that and to know that.
If Ellington had one signature piece at this time, an example of his maturing genius, it was Mood Indigo.
Mood Indigo is, for me, one of the most important early pieces of Ellington's, and I would go so far as to say it created a whole new genre which had not existed in jazz before, so therefore it's totally innovative. It is a radical breakthrough piece.
Mood Indigo, recorded on October 14, 1930, by the Duke Ellington Orchestra on the OK label. Along with Mood Indigo, Ellington also introduced other songs destined to rank with the classics of popular music. Sophisticated Lady, Solitude, In a Sentimental Mood, and Prelude to a Kiss. Increasingly, he composed longer works, finding new and more challenging forms for jazz expression. The first of these efforts was Creole Rhapsody, recorded in 1931. It ran for more than 6 minutes.
And then we recorded it on Brunswick and just about got thrown off the label. The idea of using up two sides.
It's one of these prophetic pieces, in a very
beautiful, lilting, rhapsodic way.
Gunther Schuller.
Ellington was probably the first to write rhapsodies in jazz, so here again is a kind of form innovation. You know, he never stopped composing for a minute, and he was always searching for something new.
Creole Rhapsody, recorded on January 20th, 1931, for the Brunswick label. In the 30s, Ellington was also refining his orchestra, which now included 16 members. He went out of his way to create a blend of regional and individual playing styles, a combination that, in other hands, might have sounded chaotic. But Ellington crafted this melting pot into a unique, individualized, yet harmonically integrated whole. In 1931, 26-year-old Ivy Anderson, a singer, joined the orchestra, giving Ellington another special and evocative voice to experiment with.
It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. It don't mean a thing, all you've got to do is sing. It makes no difference if it's sweet or hot. Just keep that rhythm, give it everything you've got. It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Da 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 da.
Ivy Anderson with It Don't Mean a Thing If It Ain't Got That Swing, recorded by the Ellington Orchestra on February 2nd, 1932, for the Brunswick label.
The bands, the so-called big bands, Fletcher Henderson and so on, they didn't have singers.
Gunther Schuller.
But Ellington was always interested, I think, in singers, in the vocal component. And I think this is not just some little arbitrary interest, but rather that he must have inherently thought that jazz, brass playing, clarinet playing, instrumental playing really comes out of the vocal traditions. It all sort of came together in a magnificent bouillabaisse of styles into this rich thing then called jazz.
But the strain continued between Ellington's need to be commercial, to make money to keep the band going, and his deep inner urge to experiment and push the limits of the jazz form, even if it meant losing some of his audience and alienating music critics. Ironically, it was just the opposite that alienated the critics in Europe, where he first traveled in 1933 on a tour arranged by Irving Mills. Mills had insisted that Ellington stick to his popular hits. He drew big, enthusiastic crowds, but Ellington's reviews were disappointing. Again, Gunther Schuller.
The sophisticated critics really gave it to him. They really castigated Ellington for playing a lot of the lesser repertory that he had by that time and not playing all the new innovative things. And so he came back with a kind of a strange feeling regarding that tour.
This was the start of a career-long battle with the critics, who first cited Ellington for failing to meet their expectations and later disparaged him for being too musically ambitious. Did the criticism bother him? It always did. He felt the critics in their ivory towers didn't really appreciate or understand jazz. Duke Ellington.
When a critic hears jazz, he's hearing it for the first time, and he has no yardstick to measure it with. Tolerance is the word. That's what they need.
Look into the genius of Duke Ellington on NPR's Jazz Profiles. I'm Nancy Wilson. While critical acceptance was important to Ellington, nothing really mattered more than his mother's approval, which had always served to uplift his spirits. Dempsey Travis.
Duke's high concept of himself relates back to the way his mother treated him and the way she reminded him that he was something very special. He dearly loved his mother, and she dearly loved him.
In 1935, Ellington's mother, Daisy, died of cancer. He was devastated.
Like the end of everything, you know, and I was on a long tour, and I was down, you know, I was way down, and it was a matter of looking back, because everything to me in that year was looking back. And I just kept writing, and nothing else really mattered.
According to Ellington's son, Mercer, the impact on Duke was tremendous. It was one of the most stunning blows that could have been dealt to him. For some years to come, he would only drink once a year, always at the time his mother had passed away. In 1935, he wrote Reminiscing in Tempo to commemorate his mother's passing.
It was the first really breakthrough extended work. It lasted 13 minutes and had to be presented on 4 78 sides.
Gunther Schuller.
And in my opinion, it's still the best or the most cohesive formally of all the pieces that he wrote. It is the only piece in the entire Ellington canon, which is a variation piece It's a theme that's stated right at the beginning in one of the trumpets, and which goes through, I believe, it's 14 variations, 14 reincarnations in different keys, even remote keys, which in jazz in the mid-30s were absolutely unheard of, like D major, E major, A major, and all of it is written. There is hardly any improvisation in this piece.
Many of the critics responded to this new masterwork with cold indifference.
It was totally destroyed by the negative reaction to this piece, which, in my humble opinion, in retrospect, turns out to be one of the very greatest things he ever did.
Reminiscing in Tempo, recorded in New York for Brunswick on September 12, 1935. Ellington's spiritual recovery was eventually helped along by a handsome doctor named Arthur Logan. He would become Ellington's personal physician and closest friend for 37 years.
Now, you have to understand, there was nothing wrong with Edward, you know. He was a hypochondriac. He loved the whole role.
Marion Logan, Arthur Logan's wife.
And he loved the idea of having his doctor on, from whom he would call, and have all his doctors all over the world. He would tell them, well, you have to speak to my doctor, because he understands me like no one else does.
Arthur Logan was a very loving, very gentle man.
Ellington vocalist Joya Sherrill.
He could cheer him up. He could give him positive statements and make him know it's going to be all right, like a mother does to a kid, you know, it's going to be all right.
As his orchestra regained momentum, Ellington became one of the most innovative composers and performers of the big band movement. Swing was fast becoming a national craze, led by bandleaders like Benny Goodman, Tommy Dorsey, Glenn Miller, and Count Basie. Ellington's swing was a breed apart. He was unique in that he composed virtually everything his band played, and it was always original and different. This gave the band an instantly recognizable signature sound. He went on composing at a whirlwind, nonstop pace.
I
This is Daybreak Express. This is Delta Serenade. This is Trucking.
We had to have something new, a dance to do up here in Harlem. So someone started trucking. As soon as the news got round, the folks downtown came up to Harlem. Saw everybody trucking. It didn't take long before the hi-hats were doing it, Paul Cavill doing it all over town. You see them scuffling, shuffling, truck along. It spread like forest blaze, became a craze, and thanks to Harlem now, everybody's trucking.
Band members and others were often astonished at the speed at which Ellington sometimes wrote. While a few of his classic pieces took time, others seemed to come to him within moments. Dempsey Travis.
Some of Ellington's greatest compositions were songs that were written in 15 minutes, 30 minutes, and I think A Mood Indigo took 25 minutes. That was the genius of the man.
Solitude, yeah. I wrote that in 20 minutes standing up.
What about Mood Indigo?
Well, I wrote that in 15 minutes while I was waiting for my mother to finish cooking dinner.
This is a man who never took time off.
Joya Sherrill.
He, at the restaurant, would be thinking of a melody and writing it on the napkin. He would be in the bus traveling and he's working on a tune. He never rested. There was always that greater work. He was always moving ahead, moving ahead.
Makes no difference if it's sweet or hot.
By the late 1930s, many new opportunities were presenting themselves to Ellington. He started a lifelong schedule of tours in the United States and abroad. He would perform serious works at concerts in Carnegie Hall and record more works than any other jazz composer. Ellington was composing some of the strongest music of his career, and as we'll hear in our next show, was about to enter an even more ambitious period while assembling the greatest big band in history. Our look into the genius of Duke Ellington is written and produced for Jazz Profiles by Robert Levy. The executive producer is Tim Owens. The studio producer for this program is Molly Murphy. Associate producer, John McDonald. Assistant producers are Jennifer Raskin and Madeline Smith. Post-production engineer, Rima Snyder, with help from Todd Hulslander. We'd like to say thanks to our lead advisor, John Edward Hassey. Also, Susan Jenkins, Phil Schapp, Patrick Breslin, Bob Seidman, producer Margaret Howes and NPR's Making the Music, Michael Brooks of Sony Music, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the Smithsonian's Duke Ellington Archives, and their Jazz Oral History Program, and NPR's New York and Los Angeles bureaus. Special thanks to the New York Foundation for the Arts and to the New York State Council on the Arts for their support. This program is a production of National Public Radio in association with Smithsonian Productions, made possible in part by a grant from America's Jazz Heritage, a partnership of the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund and the Smithsonian Institution. To email us or for more information about this and other programs in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts and culture an active part of their everyday lives. Additional support has been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.